It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, professor of political science, and Jonathan Hasid, associate professor of political science, joining us at our Ames studio. Jonathan and Jim, so good to have you back on the program, teaming up.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
And using Jonathan and Jim's expertise in foreign policy, a little later in the hour, we want to talk about some, you know, foreign policy's really been put on the back burner in a lot of ways with all the things going on in politics domestically. But we want to talk about a disputed presidential election in Afghanistan and where that leaves U.S. plans to withdraw U.S. troops. Of course, that's the longest U.S. war in history. The coronavirus, the politics of that. Also, tech sales, technology sales to China, the politics involved in that. But first of all, let's talk about domestic politics, gentlemen, and have our audience, our listeners, join in if you'd like. 1-866-780-9100. Join us on any of the topics today. 1-866-780-9100. Or you can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I had some other notes written up, but New York Times just posted a new article with an update. The president tweeting quite a bit this morning. So I'll just read the first couple paragraphs of this New York Times article that just appeared minutes ago. Ignoring appeals from his attorney general to stop tweeting about the Justice Department, President Trump on Wednesday renewed his attacks on the agency, demanding, quote, justice for himself and all future presidents. With a series of tweets, Mr. Trump appeared to embrace the suggestion that Attorney General William P. Barr, quote, clean shop at the department, and the president promoted the idea of naming a special counsel to investigate what Tom Fitton, the head of the conservative nonprofit Judicial Watch, described as, quote, seditious conspiracy at the department and the FBI. I could go on. Lots of details for listeners to, or Jim or Jonathan, to you to look at in that article. But it gives us an overview of what's been going on over the last few days, the latest on what's been going on. Jim McCormick, how unusual is it for a president to insert himself into the work of the Department of Justice in this manner?
It really is quite unusual and is sort of, I suppose, the hallmark of what President Trump has done in a lot of areas here, particularly with his tweets, as you were quoting there. Of course, over the last several days, of course, he's been very critical of the proposed sentence for Mr. Stone here. He obviously has talked about how he has been mistreated, at least he believes he had been mistreated by the Justice Department. And, you know, obviously has also said that Mr. Barr, although he still has confidence in him, as your quote was there, really wants him to kind of clean house at the Department of Justice and really reform the criminal justice system here.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, your view?
I mean, it's not clear what that reform would look like. I mean, the president seems to think that the Justice Department is his own personal shop of attorneys, right? It works for the United States. It doesn't work for him. Of course, the U.S. attorneys serve at his pleasure and he can replace them, but lower-level Justice Department employees are protected by the Civil Service Protection Acts and can't be fired. And so I think what the president is experiencing is the frustration that a lot of presidents have, which is that, you know, the federal bureaucracy has rules, procedures, and regulations of its own. It has its own culture, and the president can't always direct that in a way that he would like.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite remarkable that, you know, the president hasn't kind of pulled back when his own attorney general said that you're making it more difficult for me to do my job, you know, in terms of trying to have justice being blind here, and the president continues to interject himself in these various cases here.
Well, let's hear the attorney general's own words here, followed by President Trump's words. This is going back almost a week to February 13th. An interview with ABC News, Attorney General Bill Barr spoke about the difficulties of doing his job while the president comments on criminal investigation trials like his longtime advisor, the convicted criminal there, Roger Stone.
But the thing I have most responsibility for are the issues that are brought to me for decision. And I will make those decisions based on what I think is the right thing to do, and I'm not going to be bullied or influenced by anybody. And I said at the time, whether it's Congress, newspaper, editorial boards, or the president, I'm going to do what I think is right. I cannot do my job here at the department with a constant background commentary that undercuts me.
So, Jonathan, how surprising is this? Because Attorney General Barr has, in contrast to Jeff Sessions, the previous Attorney General, which the president was, he was hammering on Jeff Sessions for, what, a year before he left. Bill Barr seemed to be more of a person defending, a Trump defender there. And now this turn here, what do you make of it?
I mean, the problem is that from the president's perspective is that, you know, the people want to do their jobs and the president isn't interested in having an objective or neutral attorney general. He wants an attorney general who investigates his enemies and lets his friends off. And so yeah, I'm not surprised at all. Right. I mean, as you said, he went after his previous attorney general, Jeff Sessions, for a very long time. Jeff Sessions, we should recall, was the first Republican senator in the House to endorse Trump. So by no means like a never Trumper, right? I mean, the problem is structural. The problem is that the president is head of a sprawling federal bureaucracy and, you know, cannot control every minute part of it, including and shouldn't be involved in decisions involving prosecution of individuals, but wants to be involved in that. And so Bill Barr, who is not known as a wallflower, right, and is not seen as someone who is shy in defending the institutional interests of the presidency, apparently has been pushed too far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think also, you know, the president has really become really taken aback by, you know, the decision by the Justice Department here with regard to Andrew McCabe, you know, not going ahead with any kind of indictment of him, even though there was this kind of report of this of lying and leaking and so on.
And that was Barr's recommendation, not to go further, right?
That's right. That's right. That came out of the Justice Department. I'm not sure if it was directly Barr or, but he certainly didn't interject himself as he did with the proposed sentencing for Roger Stone. So I think that's one of the things that also has probably struck an alarm with the president in terms of responding, as well as he's now has made various statements saying that some of the attorneys that were involved in the Stone case actually were also working for Mueller. So there's a couple different things here I think that may have set off the president here.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to the president yesterday answering a question about whether his attorney general, Barr, can do his job with integrity and whether he, the president, intervened in Roger Stone's case.
Attorney General is a man with incredible integrity. Now, just so you understand, I chose not to be involved. I'm allowed to be totally involved. I'm actually, I guess, the chief law enforcement officer of the country, but I've chosen not to be involved. But he is a man of great integrity. But I could be involved if I wanted to be.
Jim, what about this claim by the president there that he guesses, the chief law enforcement officer of the United States?
Well, it does say in Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution that the president or the executive officer must take care that the laws are faithfully executed. I suppose that is probably his wiggle room to get involved in this. But this is really quite unusual that it's not unprecedented. Other presidents certainly have made their positions known. You may recall that even in the State of the Union address, President Obama took to task the Supreme Court over the United decision here. So it's not entirely unusual. I think what is unusual here is the degree of continuous involvement on a sustained kind of level. Because if you go back and look at the record, the president has made these kind of claims going back to the early days of his administration when there was a travel ban that was put into effect and he criticized, the justices in the Ninth Circuit for their action over this. So this has been of really longstanding, not unprecedented in terms of precedent, but in terms of the intensity and the involvement, I think it is unprecedented.
For those it's not who well, don't grasp the significance of this, and help me along here too, Jonathan, perhaps. The independence of the Department of Justice, of Attorney General Barr, is important to each of us, to our country. Why?
Because it preserves the rule of law. We don't want to, or at least I don't want to, live in a society where prosecutions are politically directed from the top. You know, I'm a specialist on China. This is, of course, what the Chinese government does. And it's unpleasant to live in a society like that where, you know, criticism of the president may get you a visit, a hostile visit from the FBI. I mean, this strikes at the heart of the American system of rule of law and at the heart of our constitutional balance. And it's, to me, this is a very troubling development, what the president has been doing.
It is really, you know, evident that, you know, when we make comments as the United States on other societies, and where there's not the independence of the judiciary, it's really hard to make the claim that democratic principles and the rule of law are really operating effectively.
Mm-hmm. And this, Jim, you're intimating there that this is something that the rest of the world really admires the United States for.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this idea of having these separation of powers here, these independent executive, legislative, and judicial branch, and the making certain that the judicial branch is independent really crucial to make it for an effective democracy.
Yes, Jonathan, go ahead.
Just quickly add that, you know, the people who on the right who are cheering this now may not be quite so sanguine when perhaps a Democrat is sitting in the White House and attempts to do the same thing. You know, if Bloomberg, for example, is elected, you know, he may well try to investigate the Trump family. And I suspect that people who are now cheering the president's direct involvement in the justice system will suddenly be less interested in that when they're the ones being investigated.
You know, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to pack the Supreme Court, it was another kind of real challenge to the rule of law here. And so I think we really have to be on guard on this kind of action.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Jim McCormick and Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University are political scientists. They are on the faculty of ISU, joining us this hour in our Ames studio. Let's dive over to talk about the debate tonight. The ninth Democratic debate, this one in Nevada. That's the site of next week's caucuses. This will be the first featuring the former New York mayor, Michael Bloomberg, risen dramatically in the polls. Biden has dropped. Sanders appearing very strong in the polls. Jonathan, let me start with you this time. What are your expectations? What are you watching for tonight in the debate?
I think everyone's going to go after Bloomberg because, you know, he hasn't really gotten the scrutiny that a lot of other candidates have gotten. And even though Bernie Sanders at this moment seems to be the front runner, it's dangerous to attack Sanders from the other perspective of the other candidates because Sanders' base is very enthusiastic. He's got a lot of, especially among the young, he's got a very enthusiastic support base. And so, if Buttigieg attacks Sanders too viciously, right, it may cost him support later on down the road that he may need from these potential supporters. Bloomberg, by contrast, seems to be just fair game. So that's what I expect we'll see tonight. We'll see a lot of criticism about policies like stop and frisk, about income inequality, about various crude or sexist comments that Bloomberg may have made over the years. And I expect he'll just keep getting hit over the whole course of the debate.
Jim, your expectations?
Yeah, he's target number one, Bloomberg, it seems to me, mm-hmm. you know, for all of the other candidates. And I would expect, too, that the television ratings for this debate is going to go up because there's going to be an interest in seeing how Bloomberg comes across, particularly in light of all of the money that he spent on TV ads here. So that I think, is going to be the most interesting kind of characterization that we might take away from this debate. It'll also be interesting to see to what extent, you know, the questioners, the panel of journalists here really sort of hone in on Bloomberg and some of his past statements here. From an Iowa perspective, we're also interested in some of the latest discussions that or comments that Bloomberg apparently has made about farmers and growing corn and so on. So it'd be interesting to see if there's a follow-up on that.
Some $400 million that Michael Bloomberg has spent on this campaign so far, a lot of it in the media. Let's Let's listen to a brand new ad released by the Bloomberg campaign that touts his ties with former President Obama.
A great president and an effective mayor. Leadership that makes a difference.
He's been a leader throughout the country for the past 12 years. Mr. Michael Bloomberg is here.
Together, they work to combat gun violence and again to improve education for every child.
I want to thank the mayor of this great city, Mayor Bloomberg, for his extraordinary leadership. I share your determination to bring this country together to finally make progress for the American people.
I'm Mike Bloomberg, and I approve this message.
Just one of the many ads out there online or on TV. Jonathan Haseeb, $400 million is a number to many people, but in politics, that means, in this sort of politics, that means what compared to what other candidates have to work with?
I mean, it means unlimited advertising support. It means, a get-out-the-vote organizational effort that can be built very, very quickly. Where other candidates have to struggle to get small donors, obviously Bloomberg can just simply write a check. So it's a very big deal. For the ad we just heard, I think, it's clever of Bloomberg to try to tie himself to Obama. Of course, the reality is that the president and the mayor of the mayor of New York City don't actually work that closely together day to day on policy issues. But this seems to be a way for Bloomberg to try to perhaps seize a little bit of Joe Biden's mantle as being Obama's natural successor. We'll see how effective it is.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get your thoughts, both of your thoughts, on a couple of polls this week, a nationwide survey of Democratic contenders. Today, the newest one shows Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders a double-digit lead over the rest of the Democratic presidential field. 32% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents. This is an ABC News Washington Post poll released today, well ahead of former Vice President Joe Biden, who came in second with 17%. Former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, third with 14%. We had the results earlier this week of the ABC, another NPR PBS NewsHour Marist survey showing Sanders also a wide lead over his competitors. Jim, how should we interpret these latest national poll numbers?
Well, I don't think there's any denying that Sanders has really shot up and that, he has a very activist base. I know there's a poll also apparently came out in California, which is, one of the states in the Super Tuesday, that Sanders is ahead. So I don't think we can dismiss them at all in terms of the strength of his campaign and the sort of the leadership that he really has here. I think one of the things I suppose that Sanders will have to struggle with is the degree to which he is organized in all of these different states. Apparently, Bloomberg and Buttigieg have been much better in terms of the organizational side, that turned out to be very important in Iowa and New Hampshire for Buttigieg. So I suppose there is a bit of an Achilles heel there, but I would be remiss in not taking into account these commanding leads that Sanders really has.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, Jonathan, can't we say that at this stage of the game, aren't poll numbers tending to be volatile?
Indeed, very volatile, especially at the national level, right? Obviously, I mean, in America, we don't really have a national election, really. We have 51 states that, pick electors. So, yes, it's true. A lot of the volatility just reflects the fact that, Sanders has his base and a lot of it is locked in. It's unclear. We don't know yet if Sanders has a ceiling, though, right? So he has a floor. But perhaps, there seem to be at least a large core of Democratic moderates who are less enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders and are casting around for an alternative. Whether that obviously the alternative for a while seemed to be people like Joe Biden, who's faded, or even Elizabeth Warren, perhaps as a leftist alternative. As these people have faded, it makes the race more volatile as people who are potentially, I don't know that you can use the term never Sanders voters, but people who are less enthusiastic are looking for someone new, and this seems to be why Bloomberg has gotten the attention he has.
Mm-hmm. I suppose one other thing that we could add in there is that, Elizabeth Warren, some of her supporters at least, have probably turned towards Sanders here, and the other remaining candidates are, if we might put it in sort of the moderate lane, and maybe if there is a coalescing around a moderate candidate, maybe the Sanders lead will not be quite so impressive as say maybe one or more candidates drop out and there really is a movement towards whoever Bloomberg or Buttigieg or Biden or whatever person sort of steps into that that moderate kind of lane, and then the 32% that you talked about is probably not quite as meaningful because there will be fewer candidates and more coalescing around a possible opposition candidate. I think Jonathan makes a great point here about, we don't know what the ceiling is with regard to Sanders. I think that is probably, again, something that he's got to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. What would be the repercussions of a self-described Democratic socialist at the top of the Democratic ticket, Jonathan?
Well, we don't know. I think the United States is clearly in the middle of a major political realignment, right, in part precipitated by Trump, but also by other factors. I mean, when we think about two of the major, President Trump was until fairly recently before his election a registered Democrat. Michael Bloomberg was a registered Republican. The coalitions are shifting so enormously. So it may be, obviously, if Sanders is the nominee, President Trump will go after him hard on the socialism. He'll talk about things about how he honeymooned in the USSR and had all this praise for the Soviet system. It's unclear and attacks like that would have been hugely effective even, 10 or 15 years ago. It's unclear in 2020 whether that will work anymore. I don't know. Certainly young people in my classes have never heard of the USSR, right?
Right. So, right. You have to be sort of a Cold War baby to have socialism be akin to, have a that sort of dark sense about it in a way.
Exactly. And so it may well be, there's a lot of polling that shows that especially young Democrats are much more open to this socialist label than anyone has been before. And so it may be that the old line of attacks that, a socialist can't be elected maybe won't work anymore. I mean, it'll certainly be an interesting race.
Well, certainly with, talking about free education and free health care, that's going to be very attractive to some younger voters here. Particularly who are just starting out and, maybe not in a position to really pay for some of these expenses that come along. So Jonathan's right. The Gallup poll has shown that among the young, socialist label is not something to be afraid of and to move away from. So, there will be kind of an age division here, a generational kind of gap here with regard to the socialist label.
Join our conversation. We're going to take a short break. Please give a ring to our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We're going to, a little bit later in the hour, talk about some international topics. Jonathan, a specialist on China. Of course, Jim, a specialist on foreign policy. We'll talk about the coronavirus from a political vantage point. And we're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jonathan Hasid and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, our political analysts, for this edition of the program. And before we get into some international topics for Jim and Jonathan, let's rewind a little bit our discussion before the break on the debate tonight, the ninth Democratic debate. This will be the first time Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York City, billionaire, $50, $60 billion he's worth. He'll make his first Democratic debate appearance on tonight on that stage in Nevada. Let's get in touch with Bill from Fairfield. Bill, I know you have some thoughts about the debate tonight and Michael Bloomberg's candidacy. What are they?
It's interesting, and it's kind of scary. When I look at President Trump's ability to generate money to his campaign at the drop of a hat, for a variety of different reasons, and Bloomberg's ability to spend some of his billions, perhaps, and right now it's only a half billion, but go from zero, basically, to 14 or 19%, depending upon which survey you want to go with.
Mm-hmm.
He's in second place really, really quickly, almost overnight. I mean, all of our elected officials, but specifically now the presidency, for sale? with Citizens United and all this money and all this stuff happening, is it going to be the person with the deepest personal pockets runs the country?
Bill, that's an interesting, timely question. Jim McCormick, what do you have to say to Bill?
Well, this has been an issue for really decades within the American setting. You know, back in the 1970s, there was an effort to move towards some public financing and sort of some restrictions placed upon on spending by campaigns. You know, with the emergence of PACs and so on, this has been a way to really get around that. And, you know, that has continued to make money the mother's milk of politics here. And this campaign is really demonstrating this. If we really have a Trump-Bloomberg kind of standoff, I mean, the spending, you know, last cycle here in 2016, you know, the sort of the target was to spend maybe $1 billion on the campaign. Now we're going to really up that ante, it seems to me, by both of the campaigns. One of the things that not only does Bloomberg have a lot of out-of-pocket money here that he can spend, but, of course, the Trump campaign has been really raising a tremendous amount of money as well. So they'll really be fueled for this. You know, there was a book, and Ben, maybe you will remember this, but at least I remember this, that about the Nixon campaign, and called the book called The Selling of the Presidency. And it was really talking about, in part, about this kind of money in campaigns. So this is not entirely a new phenomenon. What is new is the magnitude and the intensity that we're going to see with the spending.
Jonathan, Bill asks, is the presidency now for sale? What is your answer for him?
Not entirely. I mean, maybe just mostly for sale. I mean, you know, if talk to
Jeb Bush, and he would have an answer for that.
Yeah, that's right. Or Tom Steyer, for that matter,
right?
Yeah, who spent a tremendous amount of money in Iowa, and you know, got Bupkis here. So it's not just about the money.
All right, let's go to some international topics. Jonathan Haseeb and Jim McCormick with us this hour. If you've just joined us, the coronavirus, of course, has been headline news for many days. Let's talk about the political repercussions of the deadly virus. It has killed scores of Chinese, I think up to about 2,000. It's severely hindered the country's economy. Also, quickly becoming a serious threat to China's leadership. The death toll from this coronavirus in mainland China passing 2,000, though. The cases that are reported, new cases per day, seem to be falling. Chinese authorities tightening these sort of containment measures. Wuhan, the epicenter of this epidemic. Jonathan, with your expertise, your focus of your work on China, I'm eager to hear your thoughts about this.
Sure. It's you know, this is the most serious challenge that the Chinese Communist Party governing challenge has faced since Tiananmen Square in 1989. I think that's clear. So, for example, one thing that the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, just announced the last couple of days was that they're postponing the annual meeting of the National People's Congress. There's so-called two meetings in Beijing. This is always a very big deal every year. It hasn't been, I mean, even during SARS, this wasn't canceled. This suggests that the CCP is taking this very, very seriously. There's a tremendous amount of public anger on the internet and offline. There's a martyr now that Chinese people, can sort of rally behind, Dr. Li Wenliang, who was one of the first people in Wuhan doctor, who sounded the alarm in December about a mysterious pneumonia that was going around. The Wuhan police came and, along with eight other people, were forced to shut up. He basically was warned against so-called rumor mongering by the police. Muzzling of this early warning undoubtedly contributed to the scale of the magnitude of the disaster.
And that's at the heart of the anger?
That's part of it. Part of it. You know, part of it is that the system is not very good at assigning blame, right? So the lower level officials in Wuhan are being blamed by the national government for not responding early enough. The Wuhan officials, meanwhile, are saying, we told the national government and they gave us no instructions to release the information. And so there's a tremendous amount of finger pointing, but hardly any accountability. And from the perspective of Xi Jinping, one of his big problems is that he's placed himself front and center since he came to power in 2012, front and center in the Chinese political system. He's accumulated power unprecedented for a paramount Chinese leader since Mao. And he's basically saying, I'm in charge. And so when something goes wrong, there's no one to blame but him. And so in this case, you know, this, I think, has weakened his position quite dramatically inside China. And, you know, I mean, you can never say that a coup or a removal from office or something is likely, right? It isn't. But it's made him much more vulnerable than he appeared just a year ago. You know, he declared himself president for life. I would not be surprised if he does indeed end up stepping down, not anytime soon, but before, you know, the term of his natural life ends as a result of this.
How has modern China shown itself to be adept to remedying these shortfalls that are revealed?
Sure. I mean, you see both, you know, the Chinese government's response really shows you both sides of the system. On the one hand, information, potentially negative information, is suppressed, right? So information about the virus was suppressed, which means that the situation got a lot worse than it should have had the information been allowed to flow freely. But then the other flip side of it is that you can see these enormous centrally managed government response. I mean, where you have, you know, the city of Wuhan is cut off from the entire rest of China. I mean, this is a city of 11 million people. We have something like, one estimate I saw suggested that there's something like 700 million people under some kind of quarantine in China. There's, you know, vast public deployment of the military, of sanitation workers. And so you get this, the real strength of the Chinese system is that you can have this kind of centrally coordinated response, right, in a truly massive, gargantuan scale. But the response wouldn't be necessary to this extent if the system weren't designed to prevent negative information flows in the first place. So, you know, you really see both sides of the Chinese system from this. You see the central government's weakness and strength at the same time.
Right. And if you contrast what our country facing some kind of disaster, we have some interesting analysis I read about this. We have all kinds of nonprofits and community organizations that leap into action when there's an emergency in one part of the country, right? This is what you're describing is a system that is all sort of top directed from the top down. So it's very different when disaster strikes.
That's right. I mean, civil society is tiny in China. It's very weak. And Xi Jinping has made it smaller and weaker than when he was in office. My particular specialty is on the Chinese journalism and the Chinese media. Before he came to office, there was some space for critical journalists to report about problems inside the system. Xi Jinping mostly eliminated that space. So mostly there isn't any critical journalism done inside China. And, you know, it might have helped prevent disasters like this, right? And so it's, I mean, yes, the government's response is extraordinary, but it's only extraordinary because they cut off information flow. So in the United States, the U.S. government, the federal government undoubtedly would not be able to muster a response on the grand scale that Beijing has managed. But as you say, you know, it wouldn't have gotten to this point without the involvement of NGOs and nonprofits and state and local authorities, which all in China are just locked out.
Hmm. Yeah, I was wondering if I could just ask
Jim,
Jonathan,
jump in. Yes,
a question on this, because, you know, one of the things that China has been slow in terms of getting the WHO involved in addressing this emerging pandemic, if you will. And apparently they've cut out the CDC, Center for Disease Control, as well. That they, I heard the Chinese ambassador to the U.S. say that they would allow the CDC, but only through their affiliation with the WHO. They don't want a kind of a separate involvement of the Americans here. Is that sort of online here with their?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's in fact that the WHO team is now allowed to China, but they're not allowed to go to Wuhan, right?
Yeah.
So they're not allowed to go to the epicenter of the virus. I mean, I think this is because Xi Jinping wants to look as if it's under control domestically, right?
Right.
The idea is that if we turn to the world, then China looks weak, and China's then admitting that it can't do this on its own. And Xi Jinping.
But that's more of the kind of control mechanism.
That's right. Like perhaps other leaders we might be able to think of, Xi Jinping never admits fault.
Right.
I don't know if we can think of other leaders like that. But, you know, and so I think this would be seen as a kind of a tacit admission that China needs help.
Yep.
Jonathan Haseeb, while we have you here this week, let me ask you about other China-related news. Sales of technology have been something that have been in the news lately. This week, though, the president, in a series of tweets, suggested he did not want the U.S. to curb the flow of technology to China. This puts him at odds with many of his top advisors. Cabinet officials expected to discuss tougher sanctions on China later this month. Here's the tweet from the president. I think this is from yesterday. The United States cannot and will not become such a difficult place to deal with in terms of foreign countries buying our product, including for the always used national security excuse that our companies will be forced to leave in order to remain competitive. interesting phrase, the always used national security excuse. What do you see happening here? The president blindsiding the people lower in his administration here, doing an about face?
It's hard to know what's going on. I mean, you know, the president himself has used the national security excuse to go after companies like ZTE, which is a Chinese telecom company, now barred from doing business in the United States, and companies like Huawei, which, you know, the Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou is detained in Canada under U.S. charges, right? It's hard to know what to make of this. I've seen speculation that perhaps it indicates that Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, right, who is more interested in free trade with China, that perhaps he's gotten his way over other more China hardliners in the administration. In other words, he was the last one to get Trump's ear on this issue. But I don't know. I mean, you know, the president is very erratic in making decisions like this. And, you know, he himself has talked about the national security implications of trading with China just in the past couple of months. And so it's sort of hard to read.
The national security use of that sort of terminology was also part of the steel and aluminum ban that the Trump administration put into effect. You know, and this was what the Canadians resented so much and what the European Union resented so much, saying that, you know, putting on tariffs on those were part of this national security kind of concern. So there's really a kind of a switch here on the part of the president here. It sounds to me like, if I might interject, that it was a sort of a debate within the cabinet and the president is probably siding with Mnuchin here in terms of more trade with China.
Right. Next week it could be different, though.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
let's wind up here with Afghanistan. Jim, let me ask you first of all about this. Afghanistan yesterday declaring incumbent Ashraf Ghani winner of a disputed presidential election. Now, his main rival rejected the result and has vowed to form his own government. Against this backdrop is the U.S. hoping to seal a U.S. troop withdrawal deal with Taliban militants. Jim, your thoughts now. This is even more turmoil.
Well, my immediate reaction to this is that, given this lack of legitimacy of which government is really in power and having two kind of parallel governments, I mean, this is not the first episode of this. These same candidates were squared off several years ago, and we had this 5 years ago, and we had this sort of long decision time in terms of who won the election. I think what it does to the proposed U.S.-Taliban agreement, you know, first of all, it's supposed to be a 7-day ceasefire, and then they're supposed to start negotiating between the legitimate government of Afghanistan with the Taliban in terms of what the future state of Afghanistan is going to be like. I don't know how you do that when you have these two competing governments and the failure of the Afghan society as a whole to recognize one government as a legitimate legitimate regime here. So what I think it really does is put a real stall in this effort to get this any kind of drawdown in American forces and to get this U.S.-Taliban agreement really into effect here. And so America's longest war probably just continues.
Right. So you don't see the U.S. picking up and leaving with this country in crisis, or has it been so long?
Well, it wasn't going to really leave. Even on the proposed arrangement, there were still going to be some American forces still left in there, and they would be drawn down over time. And this, at best, we could say that this maybe stretches out that time frame. But I think the immediate implication of this lack of legitimacy of the Afghan government is that it'd be really hard for the Americans and the Taliban to go forward with this kind of ceasefire in place.
When we zoom out a bit from Afghanistan and just expand our view a little bit to the region at large, when we consider other major players and their interests, what is, Jim, what are the implications of instability, continued instability in Afghanistan for the entire region?
Well, what it continues is this dispute between the Indians and the Pakistanis over influence in Afghanistan. This has been a longstanding kind of contention here. And it'll be interesting because the president is scheduled to go to India within the next week or so. And, you know, this kind of instability in Afghanistan and the continued really instability within India itself as well will really be played out probably in that visit by the president.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it makes us ask the ultimate question in terms of U.S. foreign policy. What has the U.S. accomplished in nearly 20 years of war that began soon after 9/11 in 2001? Jim, we don't know the answer to that, do we, or do we partially?
We really don't, I was just speaking in my class yesterday about when the Russians went into Afghanistan back in 1979, they thought that this was going to be an easy out for them as well in terms of putting back into place their favored government here. And, of course, after 8 years, they finally wound down, really actually at that juncture with the help of the Americans, to get them to exit from Afghanistan. And I think that is, Afghanistan has long proved to be not just for the Russians, but before that the British and now probably the Americans, kind of a death knell for them in terms of trying to impose on that particular society any kind of democratic outcomes.
Jonathan, Jim took the lead there in analysis with Afghanistan. What do you have to add to that, your observations?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why Afghanistan is called the graveyard of empires, because
is the phraseology.
Yeah.
Thank you.
because before the Russians, the British, right?
The British in the 19th century, exactly. Yeah. They failed. Afghanistan has essentially never had an effective central government. I don't know, maybe Alexander the Great, when he conquered the region, perhaps put one in, but. Even in the 1970s, before the Soviets invaded, there was a king who had nominal authority. I mean, basically, this is a society that's never had a functioning central government. I would like to point to one very dubious accomplishment the United States has achieved in Afghanistan, and that is that Afghanistan is now supplies something like 80% of the world's opium markets. So actually, the Taliban, whatever their very numerous and horrifying faults, actually mostly succeeded in stamping out the opium trade in Afghanistan. It's now back with a big vengeance.
And who's producing it? And who's
small,
where's that
small
money?
Farmers. It's happening all over.
And is it going to what, warlords?
Warlords are skimming off. I mean, ultimately, it's going to European and American markets.
It's a cash crop, right?
That's right. I mean, this is where the heroin on U.S. streets comes from. Most of it comes from Afghanistan.
Hmm. Okay. Anything else to say about Afghanistan? We've got a couple minutes left. What else is on your minds as you look forward the next few weeks now that we have, I'm looking in the rearview mirror, impeachment, Iowa caucuses in the rearview mirror. Quickly.
Can't we talk about the Iowa caucuses a little bit more?
Do you have anything to add? We have spent so much time talking about that. I don't know if you had anything to add.
Well, this is going to be the memorable event for newsmakers in Iowa this year, right? I mean, that's going to be at the end of the year when they have a headline of what made news in Iowa. It'll be the Iowa caucuses. And I don't know what the future holds for the Iowa caucuses, but that might also be the headline story.
Well, yeah. What do you feel it is, Jim? At this point, can you say?
I'm afraid that this might be the death knell of the Iowa caucuses here. I mean, it sort of started on that Saturday night when the Register didn't give that ending poll because of some hiccup that occurred there. And then
they didn't get the information from the Iowa Democratic Party. Right, the results.
I think he's talking about the.
No, I'm talking about the Register.
The Selzer poll.
Oh, I see. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
oh,
the
yes.
Register poll on Saturday night, and then you switch onto Monday, and obviously was not a happy scene in terms of the app not working and some communication channels here. I'm not sure that the re-canvass has been fully reported. Maybe you have better information on that.
I saw that the Sanders campaign actually has requested a recount just in the last, another recount.
Another recount.
Just in the last 48 hours, yeah.
Hmm. Okay. And Jonathan, do you feel, as Jim does, that this could be the death now?
I think it is, yeah. I think this is probably the end of
and,
the
And
line.
When will we know that? When will powers that be decide that, or what will you be?
It's going to be after the 2020 election. I mean, because the Democratic National Committee will probably have to weigh in, and there will be kind of petitioning from the Iowa Democratic Party and so on. I suppose you could. I mean, the sort of the glimmer of hope was, there's been this committee now established by the Democrats here in Iowa to kind of do a re-canvass of what went wrong and what could be improved and so on. And I think that report, they've hired a couple people to do that, a former U.S. attorney, a former attorney general of Iowa. And, you know, what that comes up with, I think, might be the only glimmer of hope.
We'll leave it there. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, with his colleague Jonathan Hasid, associate professor of political science at ISU. Jonathan and Jim, always good to spend the hour with you. Thank you for your analysis.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Help today from Stephanie Nobrega. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.